Well, I'm really delighted to be here. Those of you who've been involved in putting an ITP program together know that in contrast to what they tell you, it actually takes a fair amount of work to assemble people. And of course, we went for scientific luster, and I'm really delighted at the turnout that we have for this program. David didn't tell us that we should keep soccer ability in mind also when choosing participants, but I think some of you guys will acquit yourselves very well. So I wanted to talk a little bit about astrophysical turbulence as a subject, the kinds of things that we do, where I think the frontiers are, and a little bit about what we hope to accomplish in the program, although we don't have a sort of linearly ordered set of goals. Many years ago, when I was a postdoc, Freeman Dyson told me that of all the subjects in physics, turbulence was the one that the greatest number of great scientists had failed to solve. And I think he put it even a little less politely than that. And yet, many years later, here I find myself working on astrophysical turbulence and even suggesting that the ITP have a program on it. So why is that? Well, in the first place, turbulence is something that you cannot get away from in astrophysics. And there are basically three reasons for that. One of them is that the Reynolds number in virtually any astrophysical system that you think of is much, much greater than one. So for a star like the Sun, it might be of order 10 to the 10. And for a galaxy, it might be something like 10 to the 14. So we would expect just based on that any flow would be a turbulent flow. The second reason is that it has to do with transport, and it's basically that if we consider just the microscopic coefficients of viscosity or resistivity or thermal conductivity, the amount of transport that they yield, the amount of diffusion, is typically much, much less than we infer empirically is the case. So a sort of striking example would be accretion in astrophysics. So we have a compact star like a neutron star, and we have an evolved star. So I'm now drawing the Roche lobe, the separatrix that divides gravitational influence from one to the other. So this is an evolved star, and it's transferring material through the Lagrange point, but it has too much angular momentum to fall directly onto this compact object. Nevertheless, we know from the X-rays that are emitted by the system that accretion does occur. So this material that siphons through the Lagrange point must lose its angular momentum. But how does it do that? So the viscous angular momentum transport time, just for molecular viscosity, is extremely long, hundreds of thousands or even millions of years. So how does accretion take place in a system like this? We think that these accretion disks become unstable and that the instability in its fully evolved form gives rise to turbulence and to a turbulent viscosity. So that's one example. Another example would be the solar magnetic field, which is predominantly toroidal as revealed by the presence of sunspots. And so if at a particular time, and the toroidal field reverses across the equator, so if at a particular time the toroidal field looks like this, then at a time, 11 years later, the toroidal field has reversed direction in both hemispheres, but the ohmic diffusion time in the sun is about 10 to the 10 years. So how does this field reversal take place? We think that there's some sort of hydromagnetic process going on in which the differential rotation of the sun and the turbulence in the convection zone, which I'll say more about in a couple of minutes, is what's responsible for affecting this field reversal. So those are just two examples. And the third example is that in many situations, turbulence is dynamically important. And I'll be talking quite a bit later on about molecular clouds in the galaxy, the regions that stars form from. And in the case of molecular clouds, you have an aggregate, a self-gravitating aggregate of very cold gas, which is prevented from immediate gravitational collapse by turbulent motions. And we'd like to understand sort of how to describe those turbulent motions. Can we think of them as a pressure? What's the equation of state of this turbulent medium? So those are kind of the three motivations for studying turbulence in astrophysics. Yeah?
How come in the galaxy formation people over here, even though they're running from the center of the they didn't talk much about turbulence?
Well, their stuff, you know, their stuff often looks turbulent to me.
They have shear flow, so they tend to concentrate on the divergent part of the flow. In fact, which gives rise to condensation, gravitational condensation. But the shear part also exists.
So, when these people talked about putting a million of simulations, which is n-body simulation plus hydrodynamics of gas, they were treating the full Navier-Stokes equation?
They solved the Navier-Stokes equations for the gas. I think a lot of it is just too under-resolved to see turbulence. They see very big structures, but there might be structures on smaller scales.
For some of the simulations, they do take things like the growth of magnetic fields from what we would call for smaller scales.
Yeah, I still be talking about that tomorrow in the physics department. Okay, so of course there's been a lot of great work on turbulence, but not all of it is readily adaptable for astrophysical purposes because there are effects in astrophysical turbulence, some effects not always considered in laboratory turbulence. And so one of them is extremely strong compressibility. So, for example, at the base of the solar convection zone, the turbulent region, the pressure is about 10 to the 13 times higher than the pressure at the surface of the sun. So it's an extremely stratified medium. There could be a magnetic field. In many problems, self-gravity is important. And in many problems, there are radiative effects on the dynamics and the energy balance. So in the interstellar medium, for example, if a gas is compressed, it will cool. And so density contrasts are produced by radiative effects and not by dynamical effects alone. Let me say a little bit about energy sources. So, as you probably know, a lot of astrophysics compared to other areas of physics is sort of detective work in the sense that it's not always straightforward from observations to make even a zero-order model of what you're trying to do. Some of it is just trying to find the important terms of whatever set of equations you're trying to solve. But there are obviously outside drivers. And so an example of an outside driver could be an explosion. So we think that supernova explosions in the galaxy are the ultimate energy source for a lot of the turbulence that we see in the interstellar medium. But there are also things like stellar winds and outflows and nuclear energy in the case of stars. And you could list other things. But in a way, the free energy sources are more interesting. So by free energy, I mean sort of intrinsic energy sources in the system that could cause it to become turbulent. And a prominent one is buoyancy. And this could be buoyancy of thermal gas, radiation. Magnetic fields or relativistic components like cosmic rays. Sometimes shear flows are the energy source. A relatively new source of turbulence is a shear flow plus a magnetic field. These are called magnetorotational instabilities. And magnetic fields and self-gravity. So a lot of the sort of initial work in an astrophysical turbulence problem is trying to identify any instabilities that might be present. And then, of course, the nonlinear evolution of those instabilities is a much bigger problem once you understand what the instabilities are. Any questions so far?
You pick any example you choose, could you say which of these might be more important compared to the others? I don't have.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna talk kind of by way of illustration a fair amount about buoyancy in stars, and so stellar convection is basically a buoyancy instability in systems like accretion disks that have magnetic fields. We think it's this magnetorotational instability that's very powerful, although there may be other shear flow instabilities and buoyancy instabilities. And another shear flow problem is the problem where shock wave sweeps over structure in the interstellar medium and creates little mixing layers around this structure. Self-gravity, that's the problem of star formation and also galaxy formation in the universe. And magnetic field instabilities, just purely magnetic field instabilities, we mean something like a kink instability that might occur in an outflow or a jet that has a helical magnetic field. Yeah.
In this field, all the problems that people consider are on scales sufficiently small, so you don't have to worry about the Hubble expansion, is that right?
Well, there for bound objects, you don't have to worry about the Hubble expansion. So galaxies and things in galaxies, but the question of how structure actually formed in the early universe, there you do have to do. So there's a linear theory of the growth of fluctuations in an expanding medium.
So people do worry about
that. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's very important. It leads to algebraic instead of exponential growth of instabilities. But then once bound structures form, the Hubble is slow and fluctuating. What's important.
And what about dark matter?
Well, dark matter is certainly present in in gravitational instability. It's included that way, yeah. There may also be velocity space instabilities that occur if the dynamics of dark matter particles are different than thermal particles. But I should say this list of free energy sources is only dynamical, and it's only fluid dynamical, although there are kinetic instabilities that are important as well at smaller scales. I guess you could call that a gravitational instability. Is it turbulent? Well, you've probably seen these simulations of supernova, the collapse and explosion of a supernova, and we actually now think that buoyancy instabilities are extremely important in supernova ejecta. The ejecta seems to come out clumpy, and there's some evidence that supernova explosions are asymmetrical. So this might be very important, for example, in studying the initial conditions for a neutron star and how much gravitational radiation it would produce, what its quadrupole moment might be. This could be controlled by instability.
But they also like coupling the energy into the coupling of the neutrinos into the atmosphere to
drive off
the atmosphere to bubble.
Yeah. Yeah, you get these bubbles of different leptonized matter. So everywhere you look, there's turbulence. So I wanted to say something about a couple of problems and kind of to show where we can go. And the first problem that I want to say something about is the problem of thermal convection. In stars, and I guess in a few minutes I'm going to want to show that. Whenever I want to turn it on now.
Put it on.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm not ready for it. Okay. So, in a star, we have nuclear energy sources at the center, and that leads to, so the sort of the luminosity from energy sources is fixed, and that's my high-tech component. So there's some luminosity, and this leads to an energy source, or an energy flux, which is just the luminosity divided by 4 pi r squared, the distance from the center. Now, because the interior of a star is very dense, the propagation of photons is diffusive. They scatter a lot on their way out, and the radiation and the matter are very strongly coupled. So the radiation field is almost a black body field at the local temperature of the matter. And since it's basically a diffusive flux, we can also write the flux as one-third the photon mean free path times the speed of light, so this is the diffusivity of photons, times the gradient of the energy density. And the radiative energy density is just the black body radiation energy density at the temperature of the matter, so we can write F as 4/3 AC lambda photon times times T cubed times the temperature gradient. And this is equal to whatever the luminosity tells it to be, L over 4 pi r squared. So that tells us that the temperature gradient is forced to be 3L over 16 pi r squared AC times the photon mean free path. Okay, so the temperature gradient is fixed by the requirement that whatever luminosity is produced by nuclear reactions must be able to get out by diffusion. And as you travel outward through a solar-type star, the photon mean free path drops due to a lot of bound-free absorption, and so the temperature gradient on the way out of a star like the Sun will get very large.
Can you repeat why mean free path drops?
Oh, just because the temperature is falling. So in the at the very center, everything is fully ionized. But as you go out and the temperature gets lower, there's a lot of bound-free absorption. So the photon mean free path drops, the temperature gradient goes up, and if the temperature gradient exceeds the adiabatic gradient, then you have an instability, sort of a buoyancy instability. If the temperature gradient is greater than the adiabatic temperature gradient. So the outer third, roughly, of a star like the Sun is susceptible to this instability. Now, this is a sort of a classic turbulence situation in astrophysics, and it kind of shows what we can do and what we can't do.
Could you say, for instance, in the Sun, what is the gradient of temperature compared to the adiabatic temperature? How much is it exceeding?
It's really, really tiny, and that's what I'm about to say next. So one can make a missing link theory. Of heat transport. So there's sort of a turbulent heat transport, which is of order the density, so the kinetic energy density in the fluid times the convective velocity itself. So we could call that the convective flux, and the motions themselves are driven by buoyancy. So requiring that the convective flux be equal to whatever fraction it has to be of the total flux from the star, and the available buoyancy for driving is proportional to the superadiabaticity, one can calculate the superadiabaticity that's required to carry whatever flux has to be carried. And because the density in stellar interiors is so high, the superadiabaticity which would be something like the gradient of the temperature minus the adiabatic gradient divided by the gradient itself turns out to be extremely tiny. It turns out to be of order, depending on where you are, 10 to the minus 6 to even 10 to the minus 10 in the cores of some stars. So superadiabaticity is very, very low. That means that to an excellent approximation, the structure of the convective envelope is adiabatic, and one can make models of stars that and stellar evolution that actually seem to explain the observations with a very simple theory of heat transport based on mixing length theory. So there's only one free parameter in the mixing length theory, and that is the so-called mixing length itself. So we postulate that the eddies are of a certain size, maybe this big or maybe this big, and stellar evolution theory works and stellar structure theory work pretty well if we set that length equal to a pressure scale height.
Okay.
Yeah.
If the super adiabaticity is so small, why should I really think there is strong turbulence of this heart that, you know, some of the people here are interested in? Should there not be some relatively weak fluctuations?
Well, they are very weak from the point of view of, well, the Mach number is certainly extremely low. So you don't have shock waves except right at the surface. So let's see what we can and cannot explain with the mixing length theory of solar convection.
Can you
estimate Rayleigh
number?
10 to the power 23.
Is it 10 to the 23?
Something like that.
Oh, I thought it was
Rayleigh number.
Rayleigh number. Okay, right. Because the stratification is so strong, because you have so many orders of magnitude and density from top to bottom. Okay, so. What are the effects of convection? Well, we have stellar structure, and this is kind of the gross stellar structure, and stellar evolution. And here the mixing length theory does very well. So with this very simple theory of convection, we can understand a lot about the structure of stars. But that's not all. What about an issue like chemical mixing? So in stars like the Sun and the Sun itself, the abundance of light elements like lithium in their photospheres is much, much lower than the cosmic abundance. And the lithium abundance, there's sort of a general rule with some exceptions for the lithium abundance in stars, sun-like stars, to decrease as a function of time. So we think what's happening is that the lithium is being convectively mixed. And lithium and other light elements fuse at relatively low temperatures, just a few million degrees. So if you could mix the lithium at the solar surface down to about 3 million degrees, you could get rid of it. But the temperature of the base of the convection zone isn't 3 million degrees, it's between 1.5 and 2 million degrees. And so just mixing the lithium within the convection zone is not enough. There must be some penetrative convection or convective overshoot as well. So light elements in sun-like stars must be able to penetrate below the convection zone itself. So understanding chemical mixing requires some understanding of penetrative convection. So now you really need to know something about the details of the flow, how far these convective plumes actually go. Mixing length theory will not give you that by itself. And there are other stars where there's evidence for dredge-up of heavy elements. So it can make a big difference.
How did you have to go to this 3 million degrees?
5%. It's not very much. It's not very much.
5% more than your convective.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's an unsuperable problem.
Well, when the plume goes down in the sun, it's going down many scale heights. It's getting much denser and denser and denser. So it's getting really narrow. So it's like a knife pointing down when it hits the transition.
In terms of the convection zone, 72%, and you burn the churn around the
60%. Well, the solar lithium problem is not the most dramatic example, but in evolved stars, you have convective cores, and as the cores are depleted of helium or of hydrogen, as all the hydrogen is fused to helium, that drives the next stage of stellar evolution. But if fresh hydrogen could be mixed in from the layers above, then that phase of hydrogen burning would be prolonged. So that's another example of a reason why we'd like to understand penetrative convection. We also know a fair bit about the differential rotation of the Sun, not of other stars. So the Sun rotates differentially. The equator rotates about 20% faster than the pole. And it's thought that that differential rotation profile is generated and maintained by turbulent stresses in a way that we do not yet completely understand. And finally, there's the question of the solar magnetic field. So weak as the convection convective motions are, the energy in the convective motions is still greater than the energy in the magnetic field, and so the magnetic field can be carried around by the convection, and we think that this, together with the differential rotation, are kind of at the root of the solar cycle. So we have to go farther than mixing length theory.
May I ask you would explain the first 2 points you made, namely mixing length theory in fact explains the gross features of stellar structure and also stellar evolution. Could you make some additional remarks? What aspects?
Well, what we can observe of stars are their something like their radius, their mass radius relation, the mass luminosity relation, things like that. I mean, for stars in the sky, we don't actually see all that much. And so, if you assume that the outer parts of these stars are adiabatic, that the temperature gradient is essentially the adiabatic gradient, then the mass radius relation comes out about right. And then the mass radius relation goes into predicting the central temperature, and that gives you about the right rate. The central temperature and density seem to give a luminosity, which is also about right. So describing a star as a sun-like star as an object in which about the outer one-third has an adiabatic gradient, temperature gradient, predict things like the mass, radius, and luminosity and their interrelationships pretty well. There are probably stellar structure pundits here in my program. So do you want to say anything more, John Paul? Okay.
And the evolution also, without this.
Without the mixing. At how long it takes stars to leave the main sequence, in other words, to use up the hydrogen in their cores, that really comes out pretty well, just from mixing like this.
And also the observed properties of stars that are not on the main sequence. So as the star is characterized by a luminosity and a temperature, and that luminosity and temperature changes as the star evolves. So the temperatures that are observed for stars that are evolving rapidly are consistent with something that's fully convective, for example.
What is the time scale of rapid evolution here?
Oh, rapid evolution, maybe 100,000 years, something like that.
Or even less, even 10 to the 7 years.
That's the time for a star to form. And then when a very aged star evolves for rapidly.
So, how do I get the picture there? Okay. So this image shows, there's a pointer. So for many years, we only saw the surface differential rotation of the sun. As I mentioned, the equator rotates more rapidly than the poles, and the expectation was that rotation would be constant on cylinders as one went through the convection zone, so that if you picked a point anywhere on the surface and drew the line of isorotation that terminates in that point, it would be a vertical line. And that's a consequence of the Taylor-Proudman theorem. So that was the expectation. And solar dynamo models incorporated that feature. But it's possible to probe the interior differential rotation of the sun using helioseismology. So basically, helioseismology means studying the low amplitude normal modes of vibration of the sun, which are Doppler shifted by rotation, and using them, so it's very complicated, but it can be done, to reconstruct the differential rotation profile. And this is the result of observations with the gong network. So this is, I'm not sure you can read this, but this vertical scale basically gives you the angular velocity. It's fastest at the equator, slowest at the poles. But in the convection zone, so this dashed line here represents the boundary of the convection zone, the base of the convection zone. It's really more constant on radii than it is on cylinders. So it was not at all what people expected to see. And then at the base of the convection zone, there's a pretty strong shear, which you can see over here. And the part of the interior of the sun below the convection zone that we can resolve with this technique, the rotation is much more uniform.
Can you give us an idea how many times faster is the red compared to the blue?
Yeah.
When red goes around once.
Yeah, it's about 20% at the surface.
Oh, a little bit faster.
It's not like tearing your head off.
Right.
So we're all getting exercised about that 20%, but it's a problem. Okay, so what could be the cause of this? So we still don't really know, but this is the result of a numerical simulation of the convection zone, which is not fully realistic. A lot of compromises with realism. This comes from our group at Colorado. It's mostly the work of Mark Niche, who is now in Cambridge, now a postdoc in Cambridge. It was his PhD thesis work. So this is the result. This is the angular velocity profile that is established by the thermal convection. The thermal convection transports angular momentum. There's like a net tilt of convective cells, and it can redistribute angular momentum. And it doesn't really look exactly like this, but there is some tendency. This is sort of the best case. This is why it was put on the web for angular velocity to. It's sort of not really constant on cylinders. Well, it's constant on cylinders here, but up here you can kind of get a sense of breaking away from that. So what one would like to do with these numerical simulations is sort of try to find something that works and then try to understand it, try to understand what the balance of angular momentum transport is in a star like the sun. And numerical simulations are a very powerful tool that enables us to do that. And
so what does numerical simulation mean? It means Navier-Stokes?
Yes. It means solving, well, there's no magnetic field in this problem, but it means solving the Navier-Stokes equations. In this case, solving them in the anelastic approximation, which is an approximation which eliminates sound waves, and in which you assume that the divergence, not the divergence of V is zero as for incompressibility, but the divergence of rho V is zero. And that eliminates the high frequency sound waves from the system. But it does mean it becomes worse and worse as you put in more and more density scale heights. So this is actually, the simulation is actually terminated at about 90% of the radius of the sun, because as the material becomes cooler, the scale height gets smaller and smaller. So, and this is a spectral code with Legendre functions, Avnico Legendre functions, and radial Chebyshev functions. surfaces, yeah.
The difference between this and the old Gilman and Miller stuff, the inelastic approximation, or is it just more resolution? Those are the calculations that got.
Well, Gary, they rewrote Gary Glatzmeier's. They started from Gary Glatzmeier's
right.
code, and they rewrote it.
Okay.
So, I mean, there, a lot of the changes just had to do with the change in computer architecture, but
right.
His
really
code also.
There was no change in from the old Gilman and Miller stuff except a better code.
Yeah.
And they, but
yeah.
they got the stuff on cylinders.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So, okay. So, as Bob pointed out, a low resolution study with which didn't have sort of full turbulence, it was because of the low resolution and the high numerical viscosity, it was kind of a laminar code. It obeyed the Taylor-Proudman theorem, as Bob reminded me, and so it had rotation pretty much constant on cylinders. But by increasing the numerical resolution, and that is really the main thing, the motions become more turbulent, and the interior velocity profile changes substantially. So maybe this model will produce a satisfactory theory eventually, and maybe it won't. But it's an example of how numerical experiment can be used to answer a question like, does turbulence redistribute angular momentum?
Isn't that clear from the very beginning of the program just to make it, I mean, more radial light than the light? I don't know, because it makes an exchange, you know, and I mean, it wasn't evident from the very beginning that you can have turbulence that will be more like this than on a cylinder.
I agree, yeah. It wasn't evident to me. And I don't, you know, I don't really understand it in, I mean, I don't feel that I understand it physically, but I think that it will be possible to understand it physically once the results are in. And, you know, compute turbulence stresses and things like that and see what's actually happening. And it's obviously important to do this and not just hope to, you know, publish a figure, you know, that looks like the other figure.
Yeah, but so you see that there's a different cylindrical layer, so that's why it's sort of intended to be something like that. At least qualitatively
it's clear. Qualitatively, yeah.
Cylindrical
yeah.
layer is not
controlled. Yeah. I'd like to add a point because, you know, I'm following the work of Martinich, so I have done new simulation with this hash code. And we think now that there is also a contribution come from what we call the thermal wind. And this thermal wind is certainly connected with the barophenicity of the star and the fact that the gradient of density and the pressure are not aligned exactly in the star. And we think that there is some pole equator difference in temperature could drive the weak circulation and perhaps break the constancy along the cylinder. Because the Taylor-Pullman theorem, normally you have constancy on cylinder if you don't have any terms who are coming from nonlinear or baroclinicity or viscous stress, something like that. So in the simulation we're performing now, we expect to have a break of the cylinder-like shape due to the fact that we have nonlinearity and also baroclinicity and things like that.
This is a Navier-Stokes with the Smogorinsky or some eddy viscosity or some sort.
It's not Smogorinsky.
It doesn't
know. It's more what we call an unresolved flux, where we have a term who will depend from the gradient of entropy, and because we don't want to create a too thick thermal layer at the upper layer, we associate a scaling function to allow us to reduce the thermal boundary layer on the top. So it's not really a subscript model of what you could expect by having coefficient in tune to get certain results. It's more, we take out the flux who is supposed to be taking into account by the scale we could not resolve.
Okay, so This is an example. Now, how much time do I have? I'd like to discuss -5 minutes.
10 minutes.
Okay. There are two other things that I wanted to discuss. One of them is reconnection of magnetic fields, which is, I think, something that we're going to, and the effect on turbulence, which I think is something that we're going to work on in this program. The other thing that I wanted to discuss was the example of star-forming regions in the galaxy, and I think that I would like to skip to that, and then if we have some time, maybe come back and discuss the reconnection problem. And the reason I'd like to do this is that Aki Nordlund has graciously agreed to sort of show some simulations so you can kind of see what they do. So let me try to kind of set up this problem by talking about just listing some of the things that we'd like to get out of these simulations. Thanks. So these are dense, self-gravitating clouds in the galaxy where stars form. And we'd like to understand how these clouds are supported by turbulence. And turbulent decay.
They don't collapse slower.
Well, little pieces of them collapse. So if you look at a giant molecular cloud and try to predict its future, about 3% of the mass in it will form stars, and the rest will disperse. So these giant molecular clouds, in the first place, they're giant. They're maybe 100,000 solar masses.
So, they're much larger than the genus scale of stability.
For their thermal temperature. So these are clouds at a kinetic temperature of 10 degrees. Mm-hmm. Okay. So if you sort of made all the gas have zero velocity, they would collapse. No question about it. They would probably fragment, but they would collapse. But the velocity is large, and the clouds are essentially in virial equilibrium. But we think that they evolve slowly, at least, due to turbulent decay. So we'd like to understand the support, the decay, the sources, and the effects of turbulence on star formation. And what I have in mind here is the efficiency. So why does 3% of the mass of a molecular cloud become stars? Why not 50% or 10 to the minus 3%? So there's an efficiency question. There's the distribution of stars of different masses. And finally, the clustering. And we think that turbulence may have something to do with all of these things. So I think this would be a good time to kind of see. So these simulations of star formation and molecular clouds are now doing a problem with magnetic fields, self-gravity, forcing, and I'll say maybe you want to.
Could you say a few words as to what we are going to see and what problems we solve?
Well, actually, why don't you say what we're going to see since it's your stuff?
Sure. This is isotropic turbulence. As it's known, it's about three-dimensional periodic, but it's kind of extreme. It's supersonic with RMS Mach numbers of the order of 10, and it's self-gravitating, and it has magnetic fields in it. The magnetic fields can have an energy density of either similar to the kinetic energy density or less. And we've done diagnostics comparing, for example, line profiles and statistics from observations to check whether one level of magnetic field energy is more realistic than the other, and we can sort of answer that now. But the setup is one with periodic boundaries and supersonic turbulence.
What were you visualizing there?
Well, that one was a density, and the yellow stuff is the very dense, the highest densities, self-gravitating and collapsing. It turns out that the statistics of supersonic turbulence is extremely generic and simple. it develops along normal density distribution with a spread of half the Mach number. And therefore, at the Mach number like 10, the distribution of mass is very intermittent. And a fraction of the mass, a significant fraction of the mass resides in a very small volume. And those are the volumes that collapse. So in very short words, what happens in star formation is that turbulence creates those seeds by random superposition of shocks. And then gravity kicks in and collapses the seeds.
The yellow spots are the identity.
Sorry?
The yellow is the identity.
Yes. The yellow has been just arbitrarily marked about some certain threshold.
What resolution do you have in this?
Sorry?
What resolution?
This is 138 cube.
We just have a theory for formation of densities homogeneities with almost log normal statistics, etc. Theory published already written. How in turbulence you create hybridization of density starting from a.
You can actually prove mathematically that you get a log normal exactly if you have isothermal conditions. Exactly isothermal conditions lead to an exact log normal.
Is it out of the fusion?
Sorry?
You count for diffusion too, or it's an ideal situation?
Well, no, diffusion is just a disturbing factor here. It will make the. Let's see if I can find out.
Excuse me. Are you saying that you can actually prove that the large normal distribution holds for the mass?
Yes.
What is proof here? I mean, starting from the equations?
Yes, starting from the fact that the equations for isothermal motion. Do not depend on mean density. We have a journal paper, a conference paper where we discuss this. It's based on a theorem by Pope and Ching about what is required for normality. And we can show that those conditions are fulfilled when you have isothermal and heavy stores. So this is actually a very nice illustration.
Your probability distribution of density, it changes time. Is time dependent or is it steady?
Oh, this is time dependent and this is average. But the funny thing about these curves here is that the curves are not really fits to the data. The curves are predictions based on this formula for the variance of the log rho. You simply measure the Mach number root mean square and then produce these curves and they fit very nicely with the simulations. This is caused by a lack of numerical resolution. You can't really produce the highest densities at the highest Mach numbers. So that's sort of the effect of Mach. But let me just show you first why this is sort of significant. Real star formation does take place in clouds that are very cold. 10 Kelvin, as Alan said. And with root mean square velocity that are well measured. So it's well known that their velocities are supersonic, and actually there's a well known scaling law that describes the typical velocity as a function of their size, or rather their velocity spread, dispersion as a function of separation of the points. This is something like the size to the 1/2 power roughly. And it works over many orders of magnitude. So that's sort of a strong indication that this turbulence is really turbulence. It follows the scaling law. And to view this, the most tricky way to look at it as is with density slices. And this is approximately 1 or 2 turnover times starting from homogeneous conditions. So these are the first shock that forms and then they intersect and they get sort of a mass. This mass tends to have a fractal dimension of about 2.2 or 2.3. But a much better way of looking at this is by using a volume rendering tool. So this would be the last snapshot down that I showed before. And this is a time evolution of density. So you see the first shocks intersecting here and creating those filaments and knots. And as time goes by, these then become self-gravitating. And this has been shown observationally too, that star formation really takes place very rapidly, on the order of a turn over time. But it's only affects a small fraction of the mass. And this was misunderstood before. One thought that photons was very or star formation was very inefficient. In fact, it is very efficient, but it only affects a small fraction of the mass. That's sort of the point. But once these stars are born, then the highest mass stars form supernova very rapidly, of the order of, again, a ton of the time, and then they disperse in a million years or two. They form supernova and they blow the medium to that. And that's it for that molecular cloud. But then it reforms again. It's a hierarchy. And this is a part of the turbulent scenario where the larger scales are those of the fired arms. And they, of course, have a turnover time or a crossing time much longer. And over that crossing time, many of these molecular clouds have time to form and disperse and form again. So here are some of the comparisons with observations. Some of the things you can compare is, for example, scattering in extinction, scatter in absorption of background stars. And that's a very powerful diagnostic. Another one is the relation between magnetic field strength and density. This is an empirical relation that covers 12 orders of magnitude roughly. It's very well established, as a b to the 0.4 or something. But what is not so well known is that there really is an envelope. At any one density here, you can find a distribution, and there are many upper limits that don't follow the envelope. That's again typical of intermittent supersonic turbulence. And we can actually reproduce this if the magnetic energy density is a tenth or so instead of equipotential. People have assumed that magnetic fields and kinetic energy were in equipotential, and that simply cannot be true because it violates that law. It violates, for example, the entire temperature line width relations, which here is a simulation that fits very well to three different clouds, whereas equipotential gives you no dependence of temperature on line width, and therefore this cannot apply. We can also, from these simulations, compute synthetic observations, like, for example, what you would observe in CO. CO has two different isotopes, CO12 and CO13. And CO12 is optically thick, whereas CO13 is optically thin. And therefore, the two together are very good complementary diagnostics. Okay.
How important is the magnetic field in this picture? If you get rid of it,
the magnetic field is passive. It's being shoved around by the supersonic turbulence, more or less.
It's important in the gravitational collapse, on small scale.
Yeah, but
so
creation
of making
this
a star.
Well, yeah, maybe not.
But seed creation is all that important.
The what?
For seed creation, this is also
You get basically the same statistics of density for all the kinds of things. I have to move this here, relevant to the point. The red stuff here is magnetic field strength, whereas the blue stuff is density. And you may observe that at this particular snapshot at the end, some of these clumps, which are dense clumps, have strong magnetic fields and others do not. It's a random chance. But here's a pretty good candidate for an efficient disk around the star. There's another movie that has the gravitational potential, and this is the deepest one. It's not the one with the largest magnetic field. And furthermore, when you look at one of these clumps forming, even if you have a rather strong field, it catches a rather strong field. It doesn't prevent further accretion because I can still turn mass in along the field lines. So the old story was that magnetic fields were very important as an agent to stop star formation. And I'm worried about that before the diffusion and so on across the field. But not only worried about the fact that a field is a field, it has a field line, and you can come in with mass along the field line with no problem. Well, that seems to be the main effect. So I don't think it's that important in controlling star formation waves.
So you wanted to know one thing about supersonic turbulence, what would that be?
Sorry?
If you want to know something really important about supersonic turbulence, What would the question be?
To find out exactly why this law holds, the one with half the RMS Mach number. It's an empirical one so far, but it's so good that it's probably 1/2 and not 0.5. So that would be the one I would. What more? So if anyone has a good idea about it from the Turkish community, I would be happy to hear about it. What more?
Standard deviation of
standard deviation of the density. Not the log density.
It is like 1 over
half the Mach number. Half the RMS Mach number.
Half the RMS Mach number?
Yes. In 3D. In 1D, it's the log density that does it.
Grisha, get to work now.
could you run the sequence again, please? This last sequence.
Sorry?
Could you run the sequence again, please?
Yeah.
Backwards.
So maybe I should run it frame by frame.
Yeah.
It really starts from homogeneous conditions, and the first thing that happens is planar sheets, shocks. Mm-hmm. When they intersect, and then the filaments tend to. That's actually much complementary one that shows it in a different way, maybe nicer. This is the very same data set, but it is with isosurfaces. So here are the sheets. And the sheets intersect, and there's a different isosurface here, showing a higher density. And then they again come to be shouted around. And here's that disk coming out to the front again. If I run it rapidly, you'll see them bunching around. And one must realize, of course, that these dense clumps have relative velocities, which are appreciable.
You think it reaches a kind of a steady state, a statistical steady state at the end?
Well, no, not with such gravity. You cannot reach a steady state.
Okay.
We tried to pump up the turbulent driving. This is driven all the time to a constant RMS Mach number. There's an interesting question. Can you, with sufficient kinetic energy and turbulence, simply prevents star formation? Would it keep the masses circulating or something? But it doesn't, it keeps.
No. Turbulence creates those regions of large density. Yeah. What compressible turbulence does it doesn't prevent create? It creates the region.
Yes, it does.
It depends on your forcing algorithm, because if you preferentially force where there are densities, then of course you can break it up. And that, in fact, may be the case, because if the forcing is associated with star formation, then it will occur in the gas region.
You're going to force in the supernova.
Or protostellar outflows even before it's
on the larger scale with random Poisson distributed cake with one and two.
Sort of curious, I mean, we do sort of forcing in a similar way of isotropic turbulence.
Yes.
Which is, this is isotropic incompressible turbulence, where this is very compressible.
Right.
And your whole sequence of events going from sheets to these tube-like structures to knots actually is very similar to the sequence that's followed in compressible turbulence, except by vorticity.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like
vorticity
in some respects.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That maybe that's it. Maybe.
Another interesting thing there, if you compare, of course, we can run this at low Mach number 2.
Right.
And it's interesting to ask, what is this forcing constant? How much do you have to force to increase the Mach number? You have to force it much more to become supersonic, more than proportional? And the answer is no. It's roughly proportional almost. The energy dissipation is not horrendously much larger in supersonic turbulence. And the reason simply is that most of the matter simply doesn't collide, it misses each other,
right?
Because most of the mass is in small fraction of space. Hmm. And the rest is just.
Also, the dissipation in compressible turbulence is in tiny little regions of space, too.
so you'll be able.
It seems to be similar to impact factors because you
this was the little point. Right. We can talk about it ourselves.
Yeah, I was going to say you'll be able to see a lot more of this because we're going to have a seminar on star formation. I guess not this Thursday, but the coming Thursday, and also we are reaching out to you hydro guys on Friday. This will be on a revised announcement. Axel Brandenburg and Bob Kerr are going to give a discussion of the relationship between vortex reconnection and magnetic reconnection. So magnetic reconnection was a problem I didn't have time to talk about today.
Okay. 12:15
here.
Right.
Yes. Well, that looks very promising for this.
I'm not sure it's a domestic.
Right.
You say that the bottom density is proportional.
I don't have to say
that.